Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Bly, ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient in 2014. David is a world-renowned, top-ranking, distinguished researcher. David, you've got this remarkable background with so much outstanding research and innovation contributions. Thank you for coming in today and sharing your many deep insights with the audience.
Well, thanks for having me, Stephen.
Now, David, when did you hear of this extraordinary honor, being the recipient of this ACM Infosys Foundation Award? And how did you feel at the time, and what was the reaction from your colleagues and your family?
Well, I received a phone call one night and was told that I received the award. I was surprised and delighted and thrilled and not believing it. I still feel all those things about it. My colleagues were, of course, very happy for me, and with my family. One colleague of mine, Sanjeev Arora, won the same award a couple of years ago. So quite exciting for us.
Now, you know, for the purposes of sort of the audience, we do have some younger members, and I think they'd be interested in learning what were sort of the drivers behind your early interest in computer science and mathematics.
Sure. I've been interested in computer science since I was a kid. I grew up in the 80s, and my parents at some point came home with a TI-99-4A, a Texas Instruments computer that we hooked up to the TV, and I started programming in BASIC when I was something like 7 years old. Later on, we got a Commodore 64, and I had a babysitter, Ray Sidney, who used to come over with his disk drive. We didn't have a disk drive, but we had the computer. He had the disk drive, and he was my babysitter. He came over with his disk drive and taught me how to program and showed me how to use the Commodore 64. Ray Sidney eventually became like the 8th or 10th employee at Google. We were on the East Coast, but he moved to the West Coast and was one of the early employees at Google. And my dad's a mathematician, so this kind of I've been interested in this since I was a kid. My dad really turned me on to the beauty of mathematics at an early age.
Well, it sounds like your hobby, your passion has become your career as well. So it's kind of good melding.
Yes, I feel that way too. It is my hobby. My hobby is my job.
Yeah, it's great when you love going to work, right? So.
Yep.
Now let's talk more about that work that led to your award. Can you talk about your approach in analyzing large collections of data using innovative statistical models or methods?
Sure. The basic idea behind that work, the work is called topic modeling, and the basic idea is that we have these massive archives of document collections now at our disposal, electronic archives of documents, and we need new tools, new statistical tools, new algorithmic tools to help us organize, understand, form predictions, search, visualize, summarize what's in these big collections of documents. You can think of this problem as existing in a lot of different settings, for everyday people surfing the web, for scientists trying to navigate through scientific literature, for reporters trying to navigate through massive collections of sources. There's a real need for this. And what topic modeling does is uses new statistical tools to uncover what the hidden thematic patterns are in these document collections, and then annotate the documents according to those patterns, and then we can use those annotations that were derived from the algorithm to visualize, explore, predict, and so on, whatever we want to do with the documents. So there's a lot of applications of these ideas. For example, social scientists might use this to uncover patterns in survey responses. Lately, humanists, digital, like English professors and historians, have started to use these tools to try to look at their archives of historical literature. And of course, there are technological applications, like to simply organize newspaper articles and make things available to people in a meaningful way. So that's the basic idea behind these tools. The way it works is that these tools find significant patterns of co-occurring terms. So words like cat, tuna, yarn, litter box, these words will go together in a significant way in the collection, and the algorithm can detect that. Of course, it's all done through a statistical model.
I see. Do you see any sort of ability to meld some of the work that you've done, and then let's say Tom Mitchell with his never-ending language learner at Carnegie Mellon, or Andrew Ng at Stanford, you know, with regards to his deep learning projects?
Yeah. So, well, first I should mention that the work that the ACM award is for, our early work on topic modeling, this is a collaboration with me, Andrew Ng, the same Andrew Ng, and Mike Jordan, who was my PhD advisor. And it was really the work that the three of us did together, was the kind of, beginning of my interest in topic modeling and developing this, this idea, this field. With regards first to the never-ending learning, I mean, I think that one of the challenges for topic modeling, so topic modeling really sits inside a larger field, the field of applied probabilistic modeling, where we make assumptions about data that we describe through a probability model, and that contains hidden variables. Hidden variables are hidden structures that we believe live in the data, but we just don't know what they are. So you can imagine I have a big document collection, and I think, okay, this document has some topics organized hierarchically. There's general topics and more specific topics like sports, and then there's baseball and hockey and football, and then inside sports there's different aspects of those sports. Right? You imagine this kind of hidden structure that lives in your document collection, and then using statistical inference, try to understand how that structure was instantiated in the particular data that you're analyzing. So this bigger field of probability modeling is about making assumptions about data that can, and what kinds of hidden structures live in the data, and then using algorithms, statistical algorithms, machine learning algorithms, to uncover what those hidden variables are in your observed data, and then finally using your inferences about what lives in your data to do whatever it is you're trying to do. Now, to get back to Tom Mitchell's project, one of the challenges for probability modeling, so in classical statistics, you have a data set, right? It sits, you have a data set, it's a table of numbers, or it's a big database of something, and your goal is to analyze that data set. But of course now data is coming at us constantly, and one of the challenges to probabilistic modeling, I think, is to try to understand what it means to have a probabilistic model of on a stream of data. And so if you think about topic modeling, which operates on text, then what does it mean to have a topic model where text is coming at you in a never-ending way? You know, this is similar to what Tom Mitchell's project is about, and it's something I'm interested in too. It's a challenge for this field. Now, deep learning is a separate idea, also a very interesting idea, and everybody has a different perspective on deep learning. I'm not an expert in deep learning, but I've read a few papers about it, and the perspective I like about it is that deep learning is about feature learning. It's about understanding the hidden structure, the hidden features of your data that are important for describing how it's similar to each other and how it might predict some other variable. There's a very nice new paper on the archive right now by Yeshua Bengio and Aaron Corville, and there's another author too, I forgot the name now, that reviews these deep learning methods from this perspective. So topic modeling is not explicitly related to deep learning, but there are topic models that try to learn deep, hidden topical structure. Structure, for example, of topics that live in a hierarchy where, like I just mentioned, at the top might be something general like sports, and then underneath it might be something like hockey and football and baseball, and then underneath it are aspects of those sports. Now I emphasize that the models learn this structure. We don't put in a priori that there is this idea of sports in the data. Rather, we uncover that automatically. And so in this way, it relates to deep learning. But another challenge, I think, for machine learning in general is to connect these two styles of approach. One style is this revival of convolutional neural nets, which is this new field of deep learning, or revival field of deep learning, and the other is probabilistic modeling, applied probabilistic modeling, where we're drawing more from statistics and probability models to describe data. Bringing these together has not yet really been done, although there has been some first attempts at it.
You know, there's Judea Pearl's work, you know, with Bayesian networks and counterfactuals, and then the sort of causal calculus that he's created, the sort of mathematical model for causation and so on. Do you see any kind of melding between your work and his at all?
That's great. Yeah, that's something that I was hoping to chat about. And again, it speaks to each of your questions speaks to what I think is a challenge in probability modeling. So Yehuda Perl, first of all, in 88, his seminal book really is one of the pieces of work that launched Bayesian networks, or graphical models, which are ways of representing probability models as graphs and connect intimately to how we compute about those graphs. So, just to sidetrack for a moment, I mentioned that we make assumptions about data, in this case that documents have topics that they exhibit, and then we try to reverse those assumptions. We try to understand, okay, what, given this document collection, what are the topics that it's exhibiting? The way we do that in a little bit more technical detail is to write down a graphical model of something like a Bayesian network. There's sort of they more or less mean the same thing. Write down a graphical model, a graph that represents a probability distribution that reflects these assumptions, and then use algorithms that apply to that graph to understand to make computations about the data under that model. Now, this has become an industry in statistical machine learning, and there are a few pioneering works around this idea, and Perl's book from 1988 is one of them. Okay, so now in statistical machine learning, topic models is one example of this. We are developing probability models of high-dimensional data, understanding hidden structure from them, and developing new algorithms for doing that. You know, this has been going on for 20 years. And now Perl comes out with another book, and this book is about causality. So what's the challenge? Well, we know how to build complex probability models of high-dimensional data. We know how to infer what the model, infer the hidden structure embedded in data under the assumptions of that model. But the question that remains is, well, what does that mean? What does that mean about my data? When you assume a model, you're making claims about how you think your data is organized, and inferring hidden variables from your data, inferring hidden structure in your data, that all rests on those assumptions you're making. Can you make a scientific claim or a claim about the truth in your data after doing that? Those are the kinds of questions that causal questions try to answer. I think a challenge for probabilistic modeling and for statistical machine learning is to, and by the way, that's not new. This has been a challenge for statistics for, you know, centuries, is to try to understand what can a technique like graphical models or topic models applied to data tell us about the data themselves. And there's a lot of controversy around this question, particularly when it comes to observational data. Classically, we have a question we want to answer. It's a question about the world. And so what do? We design an experiment, and we do it carefully so that we can perform an analysis on the output of that, of the study, and of the result, do an analysis on the results of the study and answer the question from that analysis. What's changed is that right now we have massive archives of what's called observational data, data that was not collected as part of a careful study that's designed to answer a specific scientific question. It's rather data that has fallen in our laps. For example, a massive collection of documents, or 200,000 amateur astronomers' pictures of the night sky, or a service that sequences people's genomes but is done so in a voluntary basis. Right, so these are all examples of data that's observational, that has not been collected as part of a careful study, but in which we think there might be some information, say, about the history of scientific thought in a big archive of scientific articles, or about our universe in the case of amateur astronomer photographs, or about genetics and our human history in the case of, say, 1 million people's genomes. So what kinds of truth live in those data is a very difficult question to answer, and that gets at what Perl's work on causality is trying to understand. Other people that work on this are people like Don Rubin, a Harvard statistician. He and Perl have a lot of energetic debates And this, I think, is a core problem looking ahead. You know, we know now how to define complicated models and compute with them. The next question we need to ask in statistical machine learning is, okay, what do these models mean, especially when we apply them to massive observational data sets? Something I'm very interested in.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. Now, you've already talked about this already, but maybe let's explore this further. What are the applications of your work and the different scientific domains that it influences?
So analyzing text directly has a lot of applications. I mentioned the digital humanities. It's one where I think people are doing some very exciting work where they're using topic models to stimulate insights about their archives of literature and other documents, historical documents. Other applications are to technology companies like recommendation systems, email analysis, right, helping you detect spam or doing more complicated things like group your email or even suggest who should be on a recipient list of an email automatically. I know that these techniques have been used for that. Recommendation systems is something I'm interested in my group. How do we take document collections and user behavior data, which documents people are reading, and use both the text and the behavior to predict what the users are going to want to read. So we're right now working on developing recommendation systems for online archives of scientific documents, like the archive. More broadly, topic models represent a class of statistical models where data represent multiple components with different degree. So a topic model assumes that every document represents a set of topics, but can represent it to different degree. Like a document can be about sports and health, or about sports and business, or about genetics and data analysis. And you make this assumption that the data are heterogeneous, and then you uncover what these distinct components are that combine to create that data. So I described it for text and talked about some applications in text, but more broadly, that idea of heterogeneous data points can be applied in other settings. In statistics, this is called the mixed membership assumption. And for example, it's been applied, models like topic models have been developed independently, in fact, to analyze human genomes, to understand that if you sequence my genome, you get some piece of Africa, some piece of Europe, some piece of Australia, that I'm somehow a mix of people from ancient history who migrated around Earth and reproduced. This kind of analysis called population genetics is very important for doing things like correcting for ancestry when trying to understand how genes and diseases are related to each other. So that's another application of these same algorithms. Another application is social network analysis. So let's say you are Facebook and you have a massive social network on your hands. You might be interested, what communities are embedded in this network? Well, again, to drive home this point about heterogeneous data, if you're on Facebook, then it's not that you live in one community. So we don't want to just cluster the nodes into single communities. Rather, you know some people from work, you know some people from the chess club, you know some people from your high school, you know some people from your university. And so each person in this network reflects membership in multiple communities. The communities are still real, right? There still is a group of people that all went to university together that are friends. But each of those people is also belongs to other communities. And the same idea of topic modeling, the same idea of understanding the multiple components that each data point exhibits, and then trying to uncover what those distinct components are from data, that those same algorithms can be used to do community detection in big social networks. So those are some examples of applications.
Now, let's talk about your future roles in research interests, and I guess there's going to be some sort of overlap from the prior discussion we just had. So how are your roles changing for 2014 and why? For example, I know you've got a new position coming up.
Yeah. So in 2014, in July, I'll be moving to Columbia, and it's a new role for me. I'll be in both the statistics department and the computer science department, as well as in this new institute for data science. And that's a lot of new roles. So first, machine learning and statistics have been, in recent years, growing together, growing closer, and there's a lot of cross-fertilization in terms of ideas between the two fields. So I'm very excited to be in two departments and to help foster that on the one hand, and also to benefit from having now colleagues in statistics as well as in computer science. In my personal work, I read a lot of statistics papers and get a lot out of interacting with statisticians, and even think of myself as a statistician. So making that formal is really exciting for me and is a new role for me. Of course, this idea that we're going to take pieces of computer science and pieces of statistics and bring them together into a new field, one possible name for that field is data science, and the new Data Science Institute at Columbia is an opportunity to really define what this new discipline that's emerging can be. Now, I don't yet have a good definition for data science. I don't think anybody does. But I'm excited to help to start to define that by being involved in this institute.
So then, what are the big research questions with topic models, Bayesian methods, approximate posterior inference, and what are the ways and processes for answers?
Right. So that's a great question. So there's different horizons for research. You know, something that my group is very interested in right now is working on, and I alluded to this earlier, working on the combination of text and user behavior data or reader data. So oftentimes we have information about who is reading articles, who is reading texts, and we have a population of people reading a bunch of documents, and we have information about what's in those documents. And those two signals together can be very powerful, both for doing traditional prediction tasks, like predicting who's going to read a document, in other words, help recommend you a scientific article that you might be interested in based on the ones you just read. But also we can learn a lot about the organization of the collection by looking at patterns of readership. So for example, with these new methods that we've been developing, we can identify interdisciplinary articles that let's say we have a bunch of scientists and which articles they've read, and we have the text of the articles. We can identify which articles are about, say, statistics, but are widely read by people in natural language processing. Or we can also identify articles that people in statistics are reading, but that aren't about statistics, and different sort of the different combinatorial space of the different roles that articles play in the collection. So that's something that we're interested in a sort of an immediate way. Some of the bigger research challenges, I've mentioned one, which is to think about causality and truth in observational data. That's a pretty pie in the sky research challenge, I think, but an important one, one we'll eventually solve. Other research challenges involving with posterior inference, Bayesian inference that you mentioned. This is the algorithmic problem of taking a model that has hidden variables and basically filling in what those hidden variables are given a big data set. We need to make Bayesian inference scalable. So with massive data sets, we need to be able to do Bayesian inference. And I mentioned this earlier too, when you asked me about Tom Mitchell's project on never-ending learning, make Bayesian inference, figure out how to apply Bayesian inference to streaming data. There's been some work on this, but this is, I think, a very important future research problem. Related to the problem of causality and observational data is to understand exploratory data analysis a bit more rigorously. So in statistical machine learning, I think we're at an interesting stage where in the 90s and in the early 2000s, machine learning was really focused on prediction. Okay, one of the classical machine learning problems is spam prediction. Is this email spam or is it a real email? And that reflects what a lot of the focus was in machine learning research in the 90s and in the early 2000s. But then as these data sets became more prevalent and available, and as people in many fields, a diversity of fields, had data that they wanted to analyze, the needs of machine learning changed, and scientists started taking machine learning algorithms that were developed to do prediction and started using them to explore data to say, look, I don't have a prediction problem really that is on my hands, but what I need to do is try to figure out what is inside these terabytes of measurements from a big telescope. And that's a problem in exploratory data analysis. And that's an area that is has hard to make rigorous and has not yet really been put under the lens of put under the same kind of scrutiny that predictive accuracy and machine learning in the service of prediction has been. And it's fuzzier. It involves things like visualization of data and understanding what's useful in data and understanding outliers. And so I think another research challenge is, and it's one that I'm interested in working on, is to make exploratory data analysis more of a first-class activity, and to treat it equal to prediction and understand, you know, what are some of the principles that can guide exploratory data analysis, general principles, if there are any. That connects to a lot of the research challenges that we work on in my group have to do with collaborating with scientists. We collaborate a lot with scientists to push us in new directions in terms of probability modeling. And so there are a lot of new problems in things like neuroscience and statistical genetics that we're working on.
You know, we've covered this really throughout this interview so far, but is there any additional applications of your work, including within text and images, music, social networks, user behavior, and scientific data?
So additional applications to the ones that I already mentioned?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I guess interesting to work with the data directly, to take things like fMRI data and other kinds of neuroscience data and build probability models and discover components and recurring patterns in these high-dimensional neuroscience data sets. That's one area of application.
So I guess you're looking at, as you mentioned, fMRIs, but magnetic encephalography as well.
That's right, yeah.
Do you see any controversies in your field, and why?
My field is very friendly. Everyone is open, intellectual, exploring ideas together. I suppose that there are controversies. You know, one might be the controversy around, which I've already mentioned, around causality and observational data. Some scholars believe that it's hopeless, that it's just not possible to make claims about, to make causal claims from observational data. Others, and I'm defining my field broadly now to include machine learning, computer science, statisticians, even social science, and social scientists who think about these kinds of issues. And some think that it is possible. I think that's an interesting controversy. It's not exactly a controversy, but there is a distinction. You mentioned deep learning earlier. There is a distinction between machine learners who use neural networks in the sense of define an objective function and then optimize that objective function to create an answer to a question about data, and those that prefer the probabilistic modeling approach, where I'm going to define a model that has assumptions, and then I'm going to use an inference algorithm to use those assumptions to compute with my data, and then use those inferences to solve my problem. There are different styles of research there. I wouldn't exactly call it a controversy. No one thinks the other is doing it wrong, but there are these different styles to computation. I personally, as you can tell, lean more towards the probabilistic modeling approach. The reason I like it is that it cleanly separates the activities of making assumptions about data, computing under those assumptions, and then using that computation to solve your problem. And so what that does is that facilitates collaborative solutions to data science problems. A neuroscientist like my colleague Ken Norman can walk into my office and say, hey, I've got all this new fMRI data from an experiment we ran, and I want to analyze it. And I say, oh, Ken, tell me about the kinds of assumptions you want to make about the data and what you want to uncover in it. And, you know, Ken and I can be at the whiteboard drawing probability models and, thinking about what, you know, how it might work. And, you know, he thinks neuroscientifically about what makes sense, and I might help us push towards models that we can compute in reasonable time about. Anyway, and then we could come up with a model. Ken can leave, and the problem of computation, the computer science problem of how to then take the assumptions that Ken and I came up with together and compute under them with Ken's data, you know, that's something that I can do with my students and postdocs on my own. Finally, once we have figured out how to compute and we've ironed out all the details, we can call Ken back and say, hey, you know, that model you drew on the board, we computed with it, and here are the results. Now what should we do with this? What is this telling us about the brain? So I like that there's this clean separation between those tasks in the world of probability modeling, and I also like that it connects to a rich statistics literature that goes back a century or more on thinking about and using probability models. I guess the final controversy I should mention, because it's so famous, is the controversy between Bayesians and frequentists. I actually don't think this is a controversy. I think this amounts to, in the old days, this amounted to a controversy about understanding truth in data, something I've already mentioned, where, you know, when is an inference real? There are different perspectives about that, and frequentists and Bayesians came up with different perspectives. But in the context of machine learning, say where we're building a system to recommend items or to cluster data or things like that, those kinds of questions don't come into play as much. And so using a Bayesian method or using a frequentist method, there's not a fundamental difference in the sense that these are just two modes of computation.
Now, this next question is probably pretty difficult, but maybe you can forecast the applications of your work in, let's say, 10, 15 years' time.
You know, I do think that, broadly speaking, my work is about organizing digital information automatically. And right now, we are bombarded with digital information and through many devices and many channels. And we, each of us, I think, has sort of developed a survival mechanism for dealing with it, right? I search things on Google. I go here for the weather. I do this for that. I do that for the other thing. Here's where I get my news. Here's where I keep up with my friends and so on. I think that thinking 15, 20 years ahead, all of that will be organized for us, and it will be much more digestible, much less overwhelming, and much more personalized. That we will have a trusted source of information about news and weather and our friends and our work. And this problem of filtering all of these many signals that right now we go and look for, I think will make a lot of progress on that problem using the kinds of methods that my colleagues and I have been developing. Not to be scary about it, it's not that no one's going to have freedom to search for and discover things that they like, but rather there will be options in place where one doesn't have to go to many, many sources, but there are these trusted ways of synthesizing information automatically for us. I think for doing things like discovering scientific literature and understanding history and seeing news that we're interested in, I think this is all going to become much more personalized thanks to these kinds of methods.
And then looking far out into the future, do you see your research interests sort of changing?
I think that in answering these questions, I've revealed what my research passions are. That you know, I think that some things that are changing for me is that you know, I started out working out primarily in text and digital media, organizing that, and I've in recent years started to look more seriously at scientific data, collaborating with scientists, trying to bring what we learned from extracting patterns in text and exploiting those patterns to extracting patterns in high-dimensional scientific data, which is different. It's less clear there. And I see myself continuing down that route, continuing to collaborate with scientists and work with more raw scientific data to help them understand what patterns are in there. Although I don't see myself deviating from text anytime soon, because I think there are many fascinating problems there, and also I'm excited about what's happening in the digital humanities, which I keep mentioning, have been using these kinds of techniques to analyze texts. I also think that looking ahead, you know, and I've become already interested in this, interested in probabilistic modeling more broadly and developing probabilistic modeling into a usable language. I mean that broadly, not necessarily a computer language, but a usable language for describing assumptions and solving data analysis problems in a customized way. I want to understand where are the holes, what's keeping people from having to collaborate with someone like me to solve a data analysis problem? Why aren't there tools out there that people can use to express themselves in terms of assumptions and then compute under those assumptions? And actually, this relates to real programming languages. Something I'm interested in is a field called probabilistic programming, which is taking this idea of let's express assumptions about data in a language, in a programming language in this case, and then redefine what compile means, compile to an algorithm that takes data as input and spits out inferences. This is getting at my vision for the future of probabilistic modeling, which is aligned with you know, where I see my research going to. Another place where I see my research going to is, and this relates to these problems of exploration and causation, is to start to sink my teeth into model criticism and model revision. Now, the issue is this. So in the past, you know, in what's happened is, we'll use Ken Norman as an example again. Ken Norman walks into my office and we decide on what assumptions to make about the data. And then, Ken leaves and my students and postdocs and I, work on developing an algorithm for computing under those assumptions to say something about Ken's fMRI data. And, that takes a long time, developing the algorithm. So, you know, we have an algorithm for identifying influential articles in a long history, and that algorithm took us something like 2 or 3 years to develop. It really was a difficult algorithm to develop. Now, in this other vision that I painted for you, where we can express assumptions and compile a program into an algorithm, suddenly the act of building models and trying models out, becomes much faster. You can much more quickly start with an idea and then see what that idea means on your data set. Right now, when it takes 3 years, you get married to your model. You're done. You're not going about to change your model because that would mean another couple years of development. So when we can do this faster, that brings up this important question of, okay, well then how do I criticize my model? How do I say, okay, this model is good, but here's how it falls short? And how do I then revise my model to, you know, in the ways that it falls short? And these questions we don't ask ourselves as much now because like I said, it takes so long to, you know, once we've developed a complicated model, it takes a long time to understand what it says about our data. So I think those kinds of questions are very important.
So it sounds like this work aligns or can integrate with some of Judy O'Pearl's work on external validity.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So the work on model criticism and model validation is intimately tied to the questions of causality and model validity, and it's vital. So when you think about inferring causality from observational data, what that means is that you need to have a valid model of how the world is working. And statisticians have thought about these problems. So a lot of what I like to work on is to really uncover and recover old ideas from statistics that when put through modern algorithmic and machine learning machinery bear new fruit. And in statistics, people like George Box and John Tukey, and Don Rubin, and actually in my new department, Andrew Gelman, Shaoli Meng, many others, have thought hard about how to do model criticism and model revision, although they were always doing it in these classical statistical contexts where the data sets are smaller and the dimension is lower, but the ideas that they have are beautiful and important, and they thought deeply about these matters. What happens when we take their ideas and then scale them up to the kinds of data sets and problems that we're looking at now?
Now, you know, when you do research and you come across really difficult challenges in your research, what kind of general valuable lessons can you share with the audience in terms of dealing with challenges in research?
That's a good question. So research can be very frustrating. It's research. You know, sometimes it doesn't go well. You have a plan, and sometimes as you're executing that plan, it doesn't go as planned. And, you know, I often am sitting with a frustrated student or collaborator saying, oh, you know, it's not working. It's really a bummer. And the answer to that is always, well, it's research. It wouldn't be research if we knew what would happen at each step. And so, you know, one piece of advice is stick with itness. You know, well, first of all, it's okay that not every path you go down bears fruit. And two, to stick with and adapt to whatever, you know, whatever comes your way as you embark on the project, and to enjoy that process because, otherwise it's not really worth it. That's one piece of advice. And another is to pay attention to the history, the scholarship, and to read, to be always on the lookout for papers that you missed from the last decades. To read them slowly, understand what they're saying, to dust off old ideas that, you know, might have been forgotten or might not seem as relevant anymore, to see what insights you can glean from them. That's another piece of research advice I like to give.
Now we're going to move to some more general questions. And as I mentioned, we do have students who are going to be in the audience for this discussion we're having. Or even perhaps even younger people than, let's say, in university. What do you believe are the greater burning challenges and research problems for today's youth to get them to get into computing?
Well, it's the challenge I mentioned earlier to me is the motivating challenge, although I know there are others, which is this challenge of information inundation, that we have been anointed with access to everything constantly, and that's a burden. And we need to solve that problem. And that's a computing problem.
Now, you're an inspiration to many because of the nature of your work and, you know, the success you've had and, of course, your now recent recognition. Can you name some people who have inspired you?
Yeah. So I'm, you know, very lucky. I've had many or several great mentors over the years. One can't have many mentors. And have also been inspired by great scholars and their writing. Some of those I've already mentioned, in terms of their writing, people like Box and Tukey, I never met them, are real inspirations to me. I always enjoy reading their papers and get a lot out of them, and appreciate their writing. Another person on that list is, I.J. Good. I.J. Good, is famous for helping Alan Turing crack the Nazi code, and wrote extensively about probability and statistics since the 50s. Is another inspiration, and another one is David Friedman, a Berkeley statistician who I was a graduate student at Berkeley. I overlapped with David Friedman. I was there while he was there, although I never met him. But his readings, which I read and reread, are also inspirational to me. David Friedman's a critic, but he's a very, you know, he takes a cold, sober look at issues or in data analysis, and I find them inspiring. In terms of inspiring people that I am lucky enough to know and have met, you know, one would be my advisor, Mike Jordan. Who really is an incredible advisor. When I got to my faculty job and was in my office and my first student walked in, I realized I have no idea how to be as good an advisor as Mike was. It's something I still basically have to strive to do. I don't make it there. You know, Mike, this is the definition of inspiring somebody who, through the way that they are, makes you want to get as close to that as possible. And in terms of being an advisor and a mentor to students, you know, I think no one compares to him. Another inspiring scholar who I've met him a few times, is Brad Efron. He's a Presidential Medal of Science winner and a statistician. He's at Stanford. And he's just an amazing writer and an amazing thinker. And he's also on that list. Anyway, the list goes on and on.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about this advisor that you sort of admire and you want to become or acquire some of that sort of attributes of becoming a great advisor.
Yeah, I don't know about becoming, but yeah.
Can you quantify that a bit more? You know, like what are the qualities that make for, you know, these great people, great advisors and so on?
Yeah, I don't know. I wish I did. But a couple things are, one thing is as a faculty member, when you take on a PhD student, or a postdoc for that matter, it's a big decision. It's a big decision for the faculty member because you're making a commitment to, help another person, somehow find who they are, who they want to become, help them find a path that they are excited about, that's satisfying to them. And it's a big commitment. So I think that, Mike respects that commitment a lot, and I try to do that too with my students and postdocs. Try to help them grow intellectually as a scholar, help them, help them land somewhere where they're doing what they want to do, where they're happy and where they're satisfied. And, taking that seriously, I think, is, one of the properties of a good advisor. Some students have the misconception that there is an employee-employer relationship. But I don't think it's like that. I think it's different.
I see. So it sounds like colleague mentorship, almost like family.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you do a lot of work and research, and you've received this ACM Infosys Foundation Award. Let's talk about the ACM. How has the ACM impacted on your work, and how has the resources supported your research? And what kind of assets do you use and are the most valuable to you?
Yeah, well, so the ACM is an amazing organization. And, the one of the ways and the way that's biggest for me that the ACM has really helped me is through their publication, the CACM, Communications of the ACM, which the ACM kind of revived. Well, I don't know if they revived. It's been around for many, many years, but at some point, 5 years ago or something, they changed the format or something about the CACM in it, and it's an amazing publication. I read it, I get it, and I read it, and I wrote, I wrote a review article about topic modeling in the CACM, and I think that did a lot for just getting these ideas out there, getting people that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to reach to hear about what we've been working on in my group.
Now, you've got this amazing distinguished career, and you've obviously picked up some lessons, broader lessons. Can you share some of them?
So I think I've touched on the main ones that I would want to mention. One is to read deeply into the literature, look at older papers from computer science and statistics and other fields that touch your field, be open to new ideas. Another lesson for the faculty members is to take your students' success and happiness seriously and to really commit to it. I guess another lesson that I've learned over the years, and it relates to this research problem we were talking about of being inundated with information, is to be protective about your time. If you want to do research and be a scientist and be a scholar, then, that means carving out time for thinking and writing and reading in the way that you did earlier, which got you to want to become a researcher and a scholar. So those are some of the lessons, anyway, that I've given myself.
Now, you've interacted with colleagues around the world, and you have an amazing group of students and others that you've worked with as well and you've mentored. From all of that speaking and work and travels, do you have any sort of stories you can share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Well, I do have one, which is that there's this big conference called the JSM, the Joint Statistics Meeting, Joint Statistical Meeting. I don't even know what the S is for. It's a giant statistics conference and machine learning conference, and it's hard to know what's going on at any one time anywhere at that JSM. And as a consequence, some great speakers and famous intellectuals will give a talk, and very few people will be there. So one time I noticed that there's this fellow, Setha Raman, who's an old probabilist in at Florida, who did some foundational work on a field called Bayesian nonparametrics, which I work in. And in particular in grad school, I read a paper of his that was really amazing paper about something called the stick-breaking construction of the Dirichlet process, and led to some work that I'm very proud of. Anyway, I'd never met the man. I was excited that he's giving a talk, and I thought, I'm going to go see Setha Raman. And I went to this room, and of course it's a tiny room, and there is this great probabilist statistician, and he's gives a beautiful talk, so clear, it was incredible. And I think in the room was me and another guy, and then I think Setha Raman's wife and son were there. I think this might have been the entire audience, which is a shock. And it was incredible. So it was like having a personal audience with Setha Raman. And afterwards, I walked up to him and I shook his hand. I said, "Oh, Setha, you know, Professor Setha Raman, I'm David Bly. You know, I love your work." And he looked at me and he said, looked at my name tag. He said, "Ah, David Bly. I've read your papers. I don't understand them." And that was it.
That's a great story. So what did you do?
I said, "I'm flattered that you tried to read them," or I don't know. I was flustered, but I liked it. I thought, that's an honest statement.
Right, and did it sort of change the format of your papers going forward, perhaps? Or
no, it just happened a couple of years ago.
So. Now, do you have sort of more broader life goals that you want to achieve?
You know, I don't think too far ahead, to be honest with you. I like being a scientist and a researcher. I also like teaching, and I like mentoring my students, and also like growing my group and meaning my group of student alumni. You know, my group, we all stay in touch. We have like an email group that we talk to each other, and when I go, you know, my students now have dispersed around the country, although many have gone to California, some have stayed in the East Coast, some have gone to the Midwest. Whenever I travel, I always look up my old PhD students and postdocs to get together with them. So my life goals are to really continue to continue as it's been going. But of course that doesn't mean to stay the same, but to continue developing and solving new problems, discovering new problems, discovering new papers and ideas and old papers and ideas that are worth reviving. I love it. I love this life.
You know, I can tell in this discussion, David, that you're quite eclectic in terms of your views and what you read. So we're down to our last two questions. And in this question, I'm asking you, outside perhaps of computer science and statistics and the areas that you're currently researching, do you see any top challenges facing us today that you want to comment on?
Oh, I see. You mean like outside of machine learning and computer science? Well, this maybe counts as computer science, but there is something that I think is a top challenge, and I admit it's one I'm not working on. But of course, you know, we can't all work on everything. And you know, I have an old friend from college, Tapan Parikh, who works on computer science for the developing world. And he's been a real inspiration to me in the sense of, again, somebody I really admire, in that what his work is about is, what can we do with our technology that can help people in the developing world, and not in the way that you might immediately think to solve that problem, which would be to, let's go to the developing world and teach, a farmer somewhere who, you know, say somewhere in India who can't read, teach him how to use Microsoft Excel, right? First teach him how to read and then teach him how to use Microsoft Excel. Rather, what TAP does is tries to figure out how can we meet his needs with our technology on, you know, in a way that makes sense for him. And it's an incredible challenge, right? How do we, kind of respecting the context and respecting the cultural parameters and the, and the financial limitations and the resource limitations. What can all of this amazing technology that we're building here in the first world and in our privileged society, how can those help others in this real way? And I think that's an incredible challenge, and I think TAP's work is inspiring in that way. And TAP has, there's a set of colleagues, he's the person I know who works on this.
Well, that's a really fascinating area, and I can see that that could be a great sort of opportunity for the audience to help in some way, or to get engaged, to look at these kinds of scenarios and ways to help.
So I work on algorithms, and then they could be used to recommend books on Amazon. But TAP thinks, you know, how can this idea of recommendation be used in another context where people maybe can't read or don't have computers? And, you know, what can we, how does it work? And I think it's a great challenge. It'd be great.
Yeah.
Students should be working on this problem.
Yeah, pretty amazing. Now, we're down to our very last question, and it's pretty open-ended, and that is, I'm sort of reversing the interview. I'm saying, if you were conducting this interview, what one or two questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I would ask, if it was the last question like this one is, I would ask, is there anything else you want to say? And now I will answer that question. There is one more thing I would want to add. You know, this interview came up because of the Infosys Award, which I'm very appreciative of. And, you know, you asked me about my mentors, and I've been focusing in the last hour on people like my advisor and other scholars, older scholars who, have inspired me. But I should add that, you know, over the last 8 years or so, you know, I've had an amazing group of PhD students and postdocs come through my lab. And really they have been, the inspiring people. And really this award is, largely due to our collaborative work and, that they drove. And a lot of the ideas that we had over the last 8 years, they really came from the students. And I was there as somebody who got to witness this great, you know, these great ideas happen and be executed by my group. You know, I owe them a lot of thanks.
Well, that's a great question and answer. And David, I know your schedule is demanding. In fact, I know you've got to go to another meeting right away. So thank you for coming in today and sharing so many insights with our audience.
Stephen, thanks for inviting me to do the interview. It was really great. I appreciate the questions and the experience.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Bly, ACM Infosys Foundation Award recipient in 2014, and David is a world-renowned, top-ranking, distinguished researcher.